This is Orson Welles speaking. Hello. Well, it's a quiet Sunday in Washington. Quiet as a tomb. Washington today is a little bit like a tomb. Because the New Deal is dead. Long live the New Deal. Weary porters are sweeping the debris off the Senate floor. Cigar-chewing senators can drop a lot of cellophane on the green plush rugs. The Honorable Mr. Claghorn throws plenty of Dixie cups around. He and his cronies from both sides of the Mason and Dixon line can fill a lot of cuspidors. They can make quite a mess that is, when they're playing at being patient, when they're sitting up all night, when they're waiting, 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 till a tired little handful of liberals in the House loses its voice. When that happens, the gentlemen of the United States Senate spring into action, and it's all over in a flash. Even veteran observers sometimes can't follow the speed of the assault. Painstaking reforms, safeguards that took 13 years to grow, are yanked up, rotten all out of the soil of democratic law, left to curl up and rattle away in the dusty wind, just part of the garbage on the Senate floor, one with the cellophane in the Dixie cups. Here's a little human right, spirit. Spirit with a little pointed stick. Drop it in a litter bag. Another human right, and another. And another. Casualties resting with the crumpled notepaper and the cigar bands on the Senate battlefield. Here's part of the greatness of an era. Roll it up and cart it off. It's dead and gone. Here's part of the greatness of a great name. Dump it down the chute. What was that name again? Oh, yes, Roosevelt. But Roosevelt is dead. Haven't you heard? And the New Deal is dead. Long live the New Deal. I've never seen a plague of locusts, but I've watched a swarm of bugs liquidating a farm field. First there's one bug, then thousands of bugs, then millions. You can't swat them. Brush them off your arm, they light on your nose and in your ears and then in your mouth. Seems like they're moving in on the oxygen itself, taking over the very air you breathe. It's like that in Washington. The Ballburton Hatch bill first. Price ceiling on labor legislation, then the Case bill. Wait a minute, nobody thought it would go that far, but it did. Went much further. An American president named Harry Truman came up with the most savage bill of all, and the Senate pounced like a bear trap. It was like a blitzkrieg in the House. An American president named Harry Truman stopped talking at 4:19. By 6 p.m., the House adjourned. The job was done. Labor was all but scuttled. Our elected representatives from here and there had set the American clock back 50 years. In the upper chamber, they were more methodical. They had plenty of votes to pass the Truman bill. But the smell of blood was in the air. You could hear the steady, quiet, careful champing of the tiger's teeth finishing the kill. There was the Case bill. First, they passed that, but that wasn't enough. They threw in the Hobbs bill and every other piece of crackpot anti-labor legislation that was lying around. All passed with votes to spare. Unconstitutional? What's that? I say it's unconstitutional. A lonely voice on the Senate floor. A lonely liberal. Unconstitutional? So what? All this infringes on the rights of man, says the gentleman from Oregon. Who cares? This abrogates the freedom of workers, Claude Pepper speaking. Repeals the Bill of Rights. Tell the senator from Florida to sit down. Rights? Human rights? Who cares about them? It's our night to howl. It's our 4th of July. We're in the saddle now, boys. Get out the firecrackers, light the fuses on the pinwheels, shoot off the guns. Let's open us another case of bourbon, boys. We waited a long time for this. We waited since 1932. Bring out the stops. Hit C over high C on the organ. Make the cat jump higher, higher, higher. Crack goes the whip. Watch them fall into line. Ain't it pretty? Senator George calls for a vote. Passed. Fine. Next amendment, please. There's a man up there in the gallery. His face is wreathed in smiles. Who is that man? He is a thing called a lobbyist. Who does he work for? A thing called the National Association of Manufacturers. Sure he's happy, this smiler with a knife. But perhaps he shouldn't be. Maybe he's wrong to smile. Could be he'll have no job next week. No job? That's right, no job. If Congress goes on like this, if Congress wrecks everything Roosevelt put on the books, what will he have to lobby for? But wait a minute, just a second. Hold on there. What am I talking about? Did this really happen? Yes, it really happened. And what started isn't over yet. It's 11 a.m. Monday. The boys are going back to work. They've got some other stuff, that is, to clean up. They've got more and even more oppressive anti-democratic legislation to pass in the Senate. They're fixing to tie labor up in knots so tight, could be that German workers under Hitler look a little like free men. Country is fed up with strikes. The constituents hunger for quicker reconversion. The nation's mood is just right for the job. But it's quite some job. Undoing so much that was done in 13 years is quite a job. The boys will have to rise betimes on Monday, and they will. They've waited too long to pass up the opportunity. The Senate sat until 1:15 a.m. Friday morning. The CIO and the AFL and the Railroad Brotherhoods didn't have a single member present in the galleries at that time. 15 million organized workers not represented. None of it makes sense, but it's all true. They weren't there when the chips were down. Henry Wallace wasn't there when the cabinet blessed Harry Truman's terrible first try at big-scale strike-breaking. Henry Wallace was missed. There was another missed in Washington last week, as he is missed everywhere in the world. He sleeps under the century-old hedges of the Rose Garden at Hyde Park. The air still shakes with the salvos of homage paid to his memory, but the eloquence leaves behind it a ringing silence. An American president named Harry Truman bowed reverently over that grave and reverently pledged fidelity. Remember? Where's Franklin Roosevelt today? Maybe he's looking down on Washington, D.C. You can almost see him, the way he used to look down on the White House lawn. You can almost see that cigarette holder tilting up at the extreme angle reserved only for victory and the most crucial defeat. Things went the wrong way for Roosevelt and the Roosevelt way in Washington last week. It wasn't for this that Roosevelt laid down his life. Roosevelt died for more, not for less. I wonder if he heard Harry Truman's enemies and his own enemies cheering Harry Truman's call for prison terms for labor leaders. If Roosevelt could send this new American president a single word of practical politician's wisdom, I think it would be this today. Harry, the reactionaries that cheer Democrats always vote for the Republicans. What about the OPA? Well, OPA won't matter much if labor is hammered into the shackles. Labor's been the thing that kept OPA working. Looks like they're crushing labor. If they do, it'll be WPA, not OPA. It'll be apple peddling, not auto building. It's like a bad dream, but it's true. This is it. Now they're cheering Harry Truman in the Senate. He's a great guy. He came through. He pulled up the sluices. He let the muddy waters of anti-labor hatred spill over. And his cup is running over. Soon it'll be all over for him. Yesterday they were laughing in Harry Truman's face. They'll laugh in his face tomorrow. Don't we have a custom on this program of reading your letters and their wonderful letters? And here's one from somebody in Victoria, a young lady who writes me, "I'm not a neurotic, Mr. Wells, nor am I a daffy housewife. I do not pretend to know the first thing about politics. I try to understand what is going on in the world today, but it's completely beyond my powers of understanding. I'm an English girl, and I married a Canadian flyer in England in 42. I've had an average education, and I think I have an average intelligence. No, I know I have. Throughout the war, I lived in London. I saw many things, but there again, I am not alone. I've lived in Victoria for a year now, and you're wondering, I suppose, what on earth this woman's life history has to do with your broadcast. Well, I don't exactly know myself. It's just that I felt I had to make someone understand how thousands of boys and girls and women and men are feeling about life now. Living in Victoria after wartime England was like after death entering into paradise, or it should have been. It didn't register after the first week, like going to see a film. Whilst in the cinema, you were moved and felt yourself actually living with the players. Whenever it left, when it was over, rather, it left a vague impression soon to be forgotten. Life to my generation, Mr. Wells, a generation grown up in the war and now facing a future of peace, is vague. We are cowards, not for physical pain or injury, but because we're afraid of a future of peace. Afraid of it. I'm very much afraid of what I do not know. That's why we need help. Living from day to day should have ended with the war. For me, when I came to Canada, should have, but it didn't. I found it didn't, and we need assurance of some description, Mr. Wells, something to believe in. I'm 22 years of age, 20 when I came out here. It's my generation which will help adjust the world today. We can't do that if we shy from the tomorrows. I have no suggestions to offer. I doubt very much if you have either. I don't expect this letter to reach you, nor do I expect anything to come of it. If perchance it does reach you, that's what I've been trying to say all along. We do not expect anything. It's like living without hope. Why have we lost our hope and our expectations of life? How can they be restored to us? At present, the majority are wrapped up in their wives, new homes, and families, but will that last very long? Soon, like others already, the rest will feel despair when listening to newscasts or reading newspapers. And what then? How about that readjustment? I'm not in the depths of despair. I'm a coward. I ignore what I read and hear. I have a sunny nature, a sense of humor, enough to eat, a roof over my head. So why should I worry about things I don't understand? Let someone else worry about it. How many others are going to feel like I do? That's the question. How many others are going to feel like I do, and what then? Signed, Anne Bears. My dear Miss Bears, you and I and most of the human family are searching for what some of us call God. Searching not for a new God, but for a new faith. Your letter defines the symptoms of the reigning malady of our age, the sickness of cynicism. The enormity of recent events have given us all a sense of helplessness in this era of the atom. We are, every one of us, stumbling into the most hopeful hour in our whole long history, crippled with the phobia of defeat. What you're saying has been said earlier, and so the problem must have been very real before the Blitz and before your coming to Victoria, before any English people came to America, before bombs and even before bullets. You are saying that man does not live by bread alone, and you are very urgently moved by this conviction. The measure of your passion in this matter is the measure of our hope. You say you're a coward, but you've written me publicly to say this, which takes courage. Why, you ask, have we lost our hope and our expectations of life? Miss Bears, if you had lost all hope and every worthy expectation, you wouldn't find it needful or even possible to write me of the loss. There must be very few thinking humans today who live without the dizzy fear of impending panic or paralysis. The bomb casts a long, cold shadow across the living world. The odor of the grave breathes out of this new darkness. Madness threatens, and despair rides its own skeleton horse after the figures of the apocalypse. On the battlefields, there is hunger and hate. Broken hopes fester in the soul, and here in rich America, we are moving backwards toward chaos. It looks hopeless, but if it were, there would be reason enough for the good fight, because the good fight is worth fighting even when the good fight must be lost. And the good fight need not be lost. If in the snug and sunny comforts of Victoria, you are wise enough to see that something stands between you and the sun, between you and those comforts, then you are wise enough to guess that you are not alone. You said that about your life in London. You are not alone, you said. Always remember that you are never alone. This comfort is the source of every living faith. Doubt is not of necessity the end of faith. It is also the beginning of faith. Why should I worry, you say? Why should I worry about things I don't understand? Let somebody else worry about it. If you didn't worry, you wouldn't have written me, and I'm sure you know the answer to that one as well as any commentator speaking into any radio microphone. I quoted these lines once before this year, but they answer you as you want to be answered. I think John Donne wrote them. No man is an island entire of itself. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. All my best to you, Miss Bears, and thanks to you, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks to you for listening. Please let me come to call again next week. Till then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Every bit of food you can save can help save lives. Orson Welles spoke to you today from Philadelphia. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.